Hi everyone, welcome to Academics Right. My name is Armand Yildiz and I have the great pleasure of hosting Sezen Ünlüönen today. Welcome to Academics Right, Sezen.
Well, hi and thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure for me as well.
Yes, definitely for me. I mean, Sezen and I, we know each other from Cambridge, where we try to learn German together, the meeting every morning.
More successfully than the other.
I mean, living in Germany helps, I would say. and then in the mean, like in the, I don't know, 8 years that I've known Sezen, unlike some of us who painstakingly could only manage to write their dissertation, Sezen also wrote two very successful and wonderful novels in Turkish. And I was thinking it would be great to talk to you about not only academic writing, but also fiction writing, which I've never done before in this podcast. Go ahead.
I'm very happy and excited to be here.
Of course, it's my pleasure. I mean, for those of the listeners who don't know you, maybe we can start by getting to know you a little bit.
Okay. Hello again. I am Sezen Ünlüönen. I did my PhD at Harvard in English literature. And currently, I am teaching as a lecturer, which is the Israeli equivalent of an assistant professor at Tel Aviv University's English department. And as Armanç has already said, I published two novels in Turkish. One is called Kıymet Şeylerin Tanzimi, and the other one, İmtiyaz Yahut Cici Kızlardır Roman. I tend to go for those long titles. here I am. As a sort of scholar of literature, I work on, my dissertation was about 19th century representations of art objects in British novels. But since then, I'm trying to sort of shift my interest and my book project in the direction of a more comparatist undertaking. And so currently I'm working on Ottoman representations of British colonialism in Ottoman literature as a sort of bridge those two things that I'm interested in.
Oh, that's so exciting. And I didn't know much about your dissertation. Could you tell us a bit about that? How does art representation or representation of artworks play into British novel in the 19th century?
I think someone once said that all dissertations are veiled forms of autobiographies. And I think my dissertation was an attempt at fighting with my own training as a historicist. In my dissertation defense, I said that I wanted to be Kant or another a German idealist when it comes to artworks, and you didn't let me. So this is the dissertation that I wrote. And Deidre Lynch, my wonderful advisor, was like, okay, now everything you did makes so much more sense. these sort of anecdotes aside, early in the 19th century, a huge influx of artworks from what was then the Ottoman Empire made their way into Britain through legal and semi-legal means. Jonas Siegel already writes about this, but the way people understood what art was and what it could tell us about the past kind of went a transformation as a result of that. Again, this is not something new for people who are doing 19th century literature or literature more broadly, but in the aftermath of French Revolution, history became a new kind of, became newly interesting to ordinary people. The historical novel that Walter Scott kind of came into existence, etc., etc. There was this odd convergence in which objects came to stand as like metonyms of the past. And my dissertation was mostly about the very strange ways in which objects can sort of like tell or not tell us things about the past. One of the chapters, for example, was about George Eliot's novel, Romulum. It's a historical novel, which even though it's written in the 19th century, the events take place in the 15th century during the lifetime of Savonarola. And the whole chapter thinks about one character's judgment about Byzantine churches and how that judgment is kind of anachronistic in the sense that it's not how people thought about Byzantine churches in the 15th century, but it's how people thought about Byzantine churches in the 19th century, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, like, as I said, with all these objects that arrive in British Museum and other places from the Ottoman Empire, with questions about how people's opinions in the 19th century about Byzantine churches are actually tied to what they think about the East or the Ottoman Empire, et cetera. I realized that there's a meaningful avenue of inquiry there that is a little bit undertapped, mostly because I was trained as a Victorianist, and most people who are trained in Victorianists aren't also trained in Ottoman Turkish and paleography. And it's a very sort of like strange set of skills that is combining, which I hope to do going forward.
Oh, that sounds very exciting. And also it makes me think of a lot of these discussions about like how to decide if an object like that is, if it's an art object or an or like an ethnographic object, right? Mm-hmm. It happens a lot also within anthropology.
And I don't think of my dissertation as a great contribution to the field, but one of the like little things that I think it manages to do is to show a historical background to a lot of these debates about repatriation, et cetera, that were still ongoing and relevant when these objects were like initially coming to Europe in the 19th century.
Oh, that sounds, I mean, I look forward to reading the book when it's out.
Well, thank you.
I mean, yeah, of course, it sounds wonderful. And I'm also curious about your process of writing the dissertation before I go more into your fiction writing. How was that for you? How would you characterize the process?
I mean, I think in general, it was not extremely neurotic, stressful process. Which I kind of feel bad, because I understand that it's a really charged experience for a lot of people. But for me, I think it was a lucky combination of an extremely supportive dissertation committee, which I think made all the difference. But also a sort of a combination of that and my maybe individual temperament in that. I take my work seriously, but I'm not a perfectionist, and I don't think of my work as like the ultimate statement on sort of like my worth as an intellectual or as a person, which this might be an overgeneralization, but I feel like for a lot of people, clearly, if you choose as your life path, this so-called life of the mind, a lot of your values and priorities are aligned in that direction. Like, you do care about ideas, you care about intellectual rigor, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know to what extent this is like something that would actually be helpful or useful to other people, but one thing that I think really helps me is that I always think of my work, even when like it's done and sent out to like a journal, or even like when it's published, as a work in progress. Like, I'm not perfect. No one is perfect. Nothing is perfect. Like, I'll do my best, and then I'll send it to other people. And if they have feedback, great. It'll just make the piece better, et cetera, et cetera. But I also, as I told you privately before, want to sort of like bring up the wonderful system of Pomodoros, which I truly think is life-changing. I mean, I don't know whether I should call it Pomodoros, because if I want to be like extremely etymologically correct, I should be Pomodori, but... I'm sure most academics who are listening to this podcast are familiar with it, but in case they're not, Pomodoros are a productivity system. There are variations, but essentially what you do is you set a timer for 25 minutes during which you work uninterruptedly, and then you take a 5-minute break. And again, people do different things. Some people are more strict Pomodorians, I guess, than others. For me, like looking up things or like retrieving items from the shelf, they don't count as Pomodoro time. Like Pomodoro is like either full focus like reading or full focus writing for me. And I'm a huge fan and proponent of Pomodoros, in part because not only do they allow me to get things done, but they also allow me to stop, which I think, again, I might be overgeneralizing from my own experience, but is a problem with academics that like our work, especially, for example, if you're in the humanities, can expand indefinitely. Like, it's not like the lab is closed, I need to go home. my books follow me home, and I could like work at 11 p.m. There is nothing to stop me. And with the sort of like intense pressure to like publish or perish, and there are no work hours, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's kind of hard to stop and not feel guilty about what you do. So the great benefit that I derived from Pomodoros was that over time I could track how much of work I was actually like physically capable. And I mean, I might be shooting myself in the foot by saying this, because we also live in a culture in which you are supposed to say you work all the time, nonstop.
Unfortunately.
Realistically, I could get like 6 to 8 Pomodoros done a day, and then like produce another 6 to 8 Pomodoros of work the next day. Like, sometimes, of course, there's a deadline and I do like, I don't know, 12 Pomodoros. But since I've been doing Pomodoros for like years now, I actually can see that if I do like 2 weeks of, I don't know, 15 Pomodoros a day, at the end of those 2 weeks, I am so exhausted that I don't have the like mental capacity to focus and do like high level thinking or writing. So if you sort of like average those out, it still comes pretty much to like 6 to 8 Pomodoros a day. So knowing that, like doing 10 Pomodoros a day is actually just taking like 2 Pomodoros off my writing capacity for the next day. Like, once I reach my, again, like 6 to 8 Pomodoros, I can stop and like go see a film or hang out with a friend and not be completely exhausted or burned out the next day. So these are my very mundane and mechanical suggestions.
Well, I mean, it's very important what you're saying, because first, as you said, not so many people are willing to admit these things. And there is really, I mean, some people get off on the cycle of like doing so much work in a couple of days and then not very little and feeling very guilty for those little work days, etc. And it goes on like this because we actually do have limited energy to do the work of the mind and writing and thinking all the time. So it's not physically possible. And I mean, that's why I think it's very important to stop before you're exhausting yourself. Like a lot of people, I think, as long as they can think of more things to write, they go on writing, but then it's really not sustainable. And this really also, I mean, you said a lot of wonderful things in a very short period of time. I want to go back to a couple of things you said. Like one was definitely being mindful of your energy and cycles as you're writing. The other thing is like doing other things to recharge, like non-academic things, which I know it also comes not so easy to like people trying to finish their dissertations, for instance, because they feel like, oh, I should be working right now. But that actually, like that other thing that you do that's not related to your academic work really recharges you. And yeah, the other thing you were mentioning is like this perfectionism and how, I mean, of course you can work on a piece of writing forever, because not only that it can always get better in terms of writing, etc., but there's always new work appearing and you can, of course, always try to include those as well, and it can be a forever thing. And I mean, if what we're doing as academics is like publishing, etc., is geared towards engaging in conversations with other scholars who are thinking along the same lines, like it needs to be out at some point. So it doesn't even make sense to try to write something perfect, because then you don't need to actually engage in any scholarly communication. You can be like, this is it, I've written it, it's done, it says the final word on this specific topic that I've been thinking about for the last, I don't know, 10 years. Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to go back to is like the community support part. I mean, this is also like, I mean, academia can be very lonely and writing especially so. Can you talk about what kind of community support you were referring to?
Okay. Before I delve into the community support part, I want to say one more thing about the sort of like guilt around like doing non-academic things or non-work things. I think again, I might be overgeneralizing from my own experience, but I feel like if most people were honest about how they work and what they get done, they would notice that after a while, they might be sitting in front of a computer thinking or feeling like they should be working, but instead they're engaging in Twitter fights or are like chasing a rabbit hole of, I don't know, Taylor Swift quotes or whatever. So the beauty of Pomodoro for me is that it got me out of that cycle in which I was too tired to work, but I thought I should be working nevertheless. And but realistically, I wasn't getting any work done. I was just sitting in front of a computer and fighting with random strangers online. But now I can just be like, okay, I did the work, so I can like go take a walk by the river or read a murder mystery or I don't know, like call up a friend. Like, so when there's no end to work, everything sort of just blends into this no pleasure guilt zone in which you're neither working nor resting or doing something pleasurable. But once there's like a actual like time limit to how much you're working, the rest of the time isn't spent in that like gray zone, but actually spent doing things that are like genuinely recharging you, as you put it. In terms of community, like I said, I had a sort of three advisor advising community situation as far as my dissertation was concerned, and all three of them, and I'll actually name them, Amanda Claybaugh, Leah Price, and Peter Lynch, were wonderfully supportive and wonderfully sort of like engaged with my work. And that's kind of like winning the lottery. I understand that not everyone gets to work with like three brilliant, dedicated people. Other than that, I think again, I might have somewhat of a sort of like unusual ideas. I think it's actually good for academics to socialize with people who are not academics, so that their socializing does not revolve around like petty departmental politics. I mean, other people might have a lot more mature and like constructive attitudes towards this, but my sense is that these tiny sort of like small competitive communities kind of foster a sense of inadequacy even when no one comes to the situation with like bad intentions. Like everyone is like a genuinely nice, supportive person, but like your friend wins a fellowship and your other friend is like publishing in the best journal, and then you are left with feeling like, what am I doing with my life? So find people whose worlds do not revolve around the latest like MLA debate might be like one piece of advice that I offer. But but the other thing is like I might again be saying this with the comfort of someone who actually has like a very close, like I'm very close with my sister. She's also an academic. So like all my academic support needs are actually being met through her. Like she gives me career advice. If she hears of a conference that she thinks might be relevant to me, she forwards it to me. She literally has read every single word I ever wrote multiple times. She's like a great editor and like gives great feedback. But I mean, over the years, I was in sort of like a departmentally organized like dissertation writing workshop group, which was very helpful. I casually sort of like send my piece like writing to my friends. And get their feedback, which is also helpful. Right now, I'm in like a professional situation in which colleagues exchange writing. So I think like in terms of like actual writing, of course, it's great to have as many eyes on your writing as you can, especially from people whose judgment you actually value and trust. But I also think it's important to have other sort of like support networks.
And then, yeah, I mean, like maybe we can now, I mean, you've done all this, you finished your dissertation and like, and you wrote two novels and very successful novels. How did that happen? How did you decide to write your first novel?
I had actually started writing my first novel before I enrolled in a PhD program. So the year before I started my PhD, I was working at a as a librarian at a small boarding school. And I started that job in the summer where there were no students on campus, but I was still like required to show up at the library every day, which was kind of like a dream job, actually. Like you are required to show up at the library every day. There's literally no one there. You get paid to do it. So that's when I was working on my first novel. I had a manuscript that was pretty close to being finished when I arrived at my PhD program. But of course, you sort of like go over it, et cetera. For the novels too, I do Pomodoro. So when I'm actively writing, working on a novel, usually like one of my Pomodoros is set aside for the novel. And so I'd like to also mention this book, which is, I think, life-changing. And the title might sound gimmicky. I think it's something like How to Write Your Dissertation 15 Minutes a Day. But if you take like, if you read the book and follow the advice, you can indeed write your dissertation 15 minutes a day and also write a novel on the side if you put aside like another 15 minutes. Like when I read interviews by other like authors, fiction writers, they say things like, I wake up at like 6 and write till like 2 in the afternoon, and then I take a break. It sounds horrible to me. I could possibly work on a novel for like, I don't know, 8 consecutive hours. I don't have like that much creative juice. Like 15 minutes a day is all I can manage. I mean, it's not to say that I never think about my novel outside of those 15 minutes. But I mean, this is true for most writing to a large extent, that and this is something the book says, that once you work on a project every day, even for like 15 minutes, it actually keeps it alive in your mind, so that as you're waiting for your turn at like the grocery store or whatever, you'll realize that you'll start having ideas about your dissertation or your project, because it's not something that you do like once every 2 weeks and then dread doing. The same principle definitely applies to fiction writing. As long as you sit down at a desk every day, without waiting for inspiration or great ideas, but just like typing, you'll begin to have ideas while you're working, but you'll also begin to have ideas while you're not working. This is another running joke between me and my sister. Like, my attitude to all writing is to think of myself as a monkey at typewriter. That like joke about Shakespeare, if you had enough monkeys on enough typewriters, typing away, eventually, like, this is how statistics works, and they'll produce all works of the entire oeuvre of Shakespeare. So I am the monkey typing away. Eventually, something good will hopefully turn up.
And I mean, also like something that I could have asked for your dissertation as well, but I'm curious. Do you write the same thing over and over again until it's like, I don't know. I know you said you're not a perfectionist, but like, do you leave the sentence when you think it's done, or do you go back to it after writing?
So I think for academic work, this is again something that book talks about, the how to write your dissertation. So I do like zero drafts, where I'm literally very different from not very different from a monkey typing away. Like, I just type words, but I poke your grammar. I mean, so usually I write without reading what I'd write, and then the next day when I sit down to work again, I use rereading as a sort of like transitional sort of like step. I will read the previous page to remember like where I left off, and as I'm reading, if there's like a grammatical mistake or whatever, I'll correct it. But I try not to read what I write too much, in part because if I read it like over and over and over again, I'll stop like seeing the problems, and I won't be able to fix it. So for academic writing, I usually, like I said, I just read like the previous paragraph to sort of like see where I left off, and then write. And then once I finished like the whole thing, I will read it from top to bottom and then like correct things. I'm not a great thinker, and so I mean, there's a great sort of like book. An academic book, both the title and the author is are escaping me now, but it's about how attitudes towards revision have changed. For example, like romantic poets thought that like literary production was this sort of like outpouring of inspiration, and then I mean, they said that, but like historical evidence actually shows that they tinkered a lot. That like it's not just one divine inspiration that is being like transcribed. So this wonderful literary critic is tracing a trajectory into the 20th and 21st centuries, where like with modernism, there's like this ethos of sort of like difficulty, and then with the rise of creative writing programs, like it's a craft, you have to perfect it. Yeah, you have to go through like 20 drafts, etc., etc. I mean, as a sort of like historically informed literary scholar, I am embarrassed to say that I actually have like a somewhat romantic attitude towards my fiction, and that of course there are parts that I go back and fix, but my general attitude towards fiction is if like something doesn't work, I just take it out, and if something works, I don't play with it. And like this is not to say that there is no change. Like I realize I repeated the same word like 5 times in one paragraph. I fixed that. I realize subject and verb are not in agreement. I fixed that. But I think most things, if I don't get it right the first time, I just drop it, which is not a productive. I don't advise people to do this, but this is honestly how I work in relation to my fiction.
And I mean, you drop it, and then what? Like, something entirely new comes, or do you kind of rewrite the idea, same idea but differently?
So, I mean, both my novels are not novels that progress linearly and are not novels that I wrote like in a linear fashion. I would write a bunch of like different scenes and then decide which one should go in what order, etc. So if I think a scene doesn't work, I just drop it. But of course, as with most writers, I am insanely attached to everything I write. And even when I know that it's bad or it doesn't work for this particular narrative, I have a hard time like deleting those like 5 pages that like took me, I don't know, 3 weeks to write. So my solution to that is when I like I'm like dropping something, I just cut and paste it to a different Word document, so that in case I want it, it's there. I have never once taken something from that document back into the original document, but it helps with my separation anxiety, I guess. And I mean, like, I don't really like rework the same ideas. I feel like if a scene like belongs in the whole, like yes, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. So it's like a very, I don't know, like a radical approach, which again I don't advise encourage other people to follow, but that's how I do
I mean, I've seen the results, so
Oh, you're very kind, thank you.
it works. And this kind of like, how does this process look like for you for academic writing then? Like, when you take something out, or like, how does the revision look like in comparison?
I mean, I think when I revise, I don't really like I said, my revisions on my own volition are mostly limited to line edits. But once I sort of like send it out to someone and they say this part doesn't work, etc. I mean, I think it depends on the piece and like who is giving me the feedback. Like clearly, what you need to do when your article is being reviewed at a journal and you have to respond to peer reviewers is a little bit different than. But I think when I receive feedback from other people, I usually give it like a week to 10 days to sort of like settle down my own defensiveness about how I feel about my piece, so that I could actually like hear the feedback that I'm receiving. And Amanda Klebo, my advisor, had once said something like which I found super useful, which is that when especially like early scholars or graduate students, when they sent out their pieces to like journals, and one like peer reviewer says, you need to sort of like expand section two, and the other reviewer says like you need to drop section two, it sounds like it's they're giving her the like writer insane and extremely contradictory sort of like advice. But you need to kind of take like a bird's eye view of what it is actually being said, which is that section two, as it currently stands, is not working. Like, you can drop it or you can expand it, but as it is, it's not sufficient. So I try to take that view of what people are saying about my writing. That I mean, I might not necessarily agree with the particular solution that they're offering, but I try to hear that, like, clearly, my definition of this concept does not translate into a clear understanding in the reader's experience or whatever. And I try not to be like too wedded to what I put on the page or like even the general structure. I mean, I guess like my lack of perfection is coupled with a sense of optimism that like I've had good ideas in the past, I'll have good ideas in the future. It doesn't have to be this one particular idea if people don't think that it works. Like if people who are giving me feedback tell me to expand the section, I expand the section. If they want me to rethink this or like terms of the discussion, I do it. I mean, like, I'm like a puppy, or not a puppy, but like a well-trained dog. Like, you tell me, I do it.
But I mean, it is a good strategy to kind of externalize the review process, right? Like revision process. Like it's not like, I mean, of course you can, as you said, like work on it forever by yourself and try to fix it, but then at some point other people need to read it and then tell you
Make
what
them
works and
their
what doesn't.
make it their problem.
Exactly. And I mean, I think we're coming towards the end of our time. I want to ask you, what would be the one piece of writing advice you wish you had at the beginning of your PhD?
I don't know if this is a writing advice, but and people I think had told me this, but I didn't hear it. I think I came to do an English literature PhD because I thought I love literature. I love George Eliot. So here's another chance for me to work on George Eliot, where I will offer my like brilliant readings of George Eliot to posterity. But for better or for worse, and there are things to be said against it, but our profession is not a profession about reading George Eliot. It's a profession about producing new knowledge about literature. And producing new knowledge necessarily entails engagement with things that are not canonical novels that have been written about hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. So I think it's only at the end of my PhD that I finally understand that my job is not to read George Eliot. My job is to give people or tell people something that they didn't know. Understanding what your field sees as a sort of like legitimate area of inquiry, legitimate question. I mean, again, I don't know, maybe other people are a lot less than you about what PhDs are, but that would have, again, this is not that other people didn't tell me this, but I wish I had heard it earlier and organized my research around that earlier.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. I had a wonderful time talking to you about your writing adventures.
Well, I had a great time too. Thank you so much.
This is Academics Riot, and my name is Armand Yildiz. I had a wonderful pleasure of talking to Sezen Ünlü about not only her dissertation, but also two wonderful novels. Until next time.